Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Author, artist, and naturalist Julie Zicafous is known for her deeply affecting insights on all things nature, birds, insects, plants, you name it. She is renowned for both her art and her stories about her encounters in nature, from the recovery and salvation of a baby blue jay to the joys of roaming the hills and dales of the Appalachian foothills of southern Ohio, where she lives. Recently, she turned her sights to landscaping, creating an outdoor room, and that's as delightful an episode as any in her tremendous blog. We'll post a link to her blog at WOSU.org/allsides. For now, Julie Zicafous joins us in conversation. Welcome back, Julie.
Well, hello, Ann. I've missed you so much. It's been a while.
It has been a while. Too, way too long. You're up there in your lookout tower, I see.
I am. It's the only place I can get reliable internet. Plus, it makes me look like Rapunzel.
You talked about how in at the beginning of your latest blog post that the pandemic sort of set people to work on what was before them, their homes and gardens. And that's a really important thing to you, but you'd let things slide for the last few years. So you got to it.
Right, exactly. And I actually had a year's jump on everybody here because I got real serious about cleaning up the property. And when I say cleaning up the property, I'm talking about 80 acres.
Yeah.
So it's not trivial. Got real serious about it in the winter of 2018-2019. And we hadn't been able to get a tractor through to mow a lot of the paths. And we'd had about 30 trees fallen to deal with that were left over from the derecho of 2018. Mm-hmm. So it was, I'll tell you what, it was a mess. And now it's not a mess. So I'm really, really enjoying it. And I'd love to get you down here to walk with me.
Yeah, you bet. A lot of work though. And then you created this patio, and I was kind of surprised that you didn't already have a place like that, but you didn't.
No, I didn't. And you know, it's one of those things that kind of grew out of not wanting to mow a particularly troublesome corner. And that was the simple impetus. I was like, what if I put some stones down here instead of this, you know, weed patch? And then I thought, well, wait a minute, I could like be like a grown-up and make a patio. That would be cool. And I invited a landscaper out and we talked about it. And then to that, I added a great big honkin' flower bed that, yeah, I could literally grow pawpaw trees in. It's enormous. Right now it's got zinnias and coxcomb, but it's been really, really fun. And I knew we needed it because we had been sitting outside in lawn chairs under a Japanese maple for years. That was our outdoor living,
yeah,
room. And that's been a wonderful place for me to release my baby songbirds that I raise, you know, mm-hmm, because it's like, yeah, they're sitting in the living room with us, you know? So, so from there we've segued to this beautiful stone patio and I'm just enjoying it so much.
I thought it was, you know, you're all about nature and that's what we usually talk about. And it felt like reading your piece that you're unaccustomed to carving out a place for yourself in all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. And, you know, one of my focuses during the quarantine has been to take better care of myself and what I might need, because I'm always, you know, taking care of birds and plants and you name it, and my family, you know, taking, mm-hmm, care of my kids and cooking for everybody. And so I thought, you know, what do I want? How would I like to inhabit these spaces? And that's been great. It really has. I mean, the only problem is I never sit down. So I stand there and I go, boy, this is a nice patio. It'd be a nice place to sit for a bit. I see some weeds over there. I got to go pull. So
someday. It's a someday kind of a place. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We have Julie Zicafous, naturalist, artist, author of several books, including Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay, and many others, with us for the hour. If you have a question or comment for Julie Zicafous, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, the new patio has also created a new outpost for you. It's a new perspective from which to observe the world around you. How are you enjoying that?
Oh, that's amazing. I mean, when you just stay outside for most of the day and just listen to what goes on around you. It's incredible, you know, the little events and the little dramas that are taking place. It's my sort of line into what the birds are up to. And this time of year is particularly intriguing because the birds are slowing down, they're singing, but that's because they're so busy feeding their own young. So what I'm listening for right now is the little quiet chirps and cheeps of baby birds in the undergrowth being tended by their parents, and I'm watching for that activity. In fact, this morning I was doing my morning walk. I call my morning practice with my dog, and and just going through the meadow, and a female indigo bunting flew low in front of me, maybe a foot off the ground, with her feathers all puffed out in a ball and flying as if she barely knew how to do it, and crisscrossing the path in front of me like, I'm a baby bird. How about you follow me? I'm a really lousy flyer. You could probably catch me. And that was her distraction display. So I knew right away that there was a nest with young in it very close.
What's new out there this year? Anything?
Yeah, we had a really interesting phenomenon. I continue to study orchard orioles because they're one of the lesser known species in our North American avifauna. I'm not really sure why we know so little about orchard orioles, but the popular opinion has been that orchard orioles have one brood, and then they leave very early for the wintering grounds in Central America. Yeah, and I've always kind of wondered about that. Well, on June 16th, I had a pair of orchard orioles just blow into the place with three fledglings in tow. And it wasn't, the male started singing and acted as if he was setting up a territory while feeding his grown babies from elsewhere. And the female immediately built a nest and laid eggs. And I thought, well, that could easily have been perceived as the birds departing for the wintering grounds, unless I happened to intercept them here and, you know, in Whipple and say, oh, look, you're doing a second brood, aren't you? So there's always stuff to be learned about the birds, you know, that we think we know. And that's what I love. I absolutely love documenting things like this with photographs and stories and anecdotes.
I think, you know, just from talking with you and Ken Kaufman and, you know, your late spouse, Bill Thompson III, and so many other people out there like you, Bernie Master. Bernie Master, who's one of the top, I guess, amateur is, you know, birding people in the world here in Worthington. It's fascinating to me how much we don't know. I say we, kind of the royal way there, right? I don't know anything,
right.
But about birds.
It is fascinating. Yeah.
They don't talk to us even in the same way that our dogs
mysteries.
Do, right?
Yeah, mysteries cast into light, you know, all the time. We're always coming up with something that we really need to know that we don't know.
Yeah. And it's so much of it is just pure observation and so on. And there is a huge mystery right now with this strange illness. And I know you've been theorizing and speculating a lot on it and trying to figure out because, you know, biology is your background and you know a thing or two. So give us a thumbnail. We can talk a lot more, but a thumbnail of what your thoughts are on this condition afflicting the birds.
Well, thank you for calling it a condition afflicting the birds. I appreciate your precise wording because there have been a lot of press releases flatly stating that it's a disease, stating that it's infectious. And those are definitely two different things, disease and affliction. So I persist in stubbornly calling it an affliction. And I don't know that we have not isolated, I say we, again, the royal we, researchers at the USGS in various labs have failed to isolate any pathogen that is causing this. And so as a wildlife rehabilitator for so many years, I immediately, when I saw the symptoms, which include desiccated and crusty and oozing eyes, which are eventually completely destroyed by this affliction, so the bird is blinded. And I saw that, and then I saw the neurological symptoms people were reporting, where the birds are trembling, they're unable to walk, they're unable to fly. And my mind went to toxicity of some kind. When a bird is exposed to a toxin, particularly a neurotoxin, you'll see tremors and ataxia, inability to keep their balance. And so I have been thinking more along the lines of some kind of toxin, for what that's worth. There are a couple of possibilities. One possibility that I first was thinking about in late May, when this really came on the scene, mm-hmm. was perhaps people spraying for cicadas were loading them up with pesticides. And what happens in a cicada outbreak year is that there is such abundant food, literally the birds are wading through food on the ground. And what I have observed in a number of different species, from eastern bluebird, brown thrasher, scarlet tanager, Carolina wren, northern cardinal, blue jay, grackle, flicker, what they do is they beat the cicada up, they remove the wings and thorax, and they just feed the abdomen, the soft abdomen to their young. Mm-hmm. So what was interesting about the birds that were coming in to rehabs is that they were limited to these species: blue jay, common grackle, American robin, a few cardinals, European starling, lots of those. And I thought, okay, let's look at this as a set. What do all these birds have in common? Mm-hmm. And I went, body size. They're big enough to eat a cicada abdomen. Hmm. Furthermore, they were coming in overwhelmingly in areas that were affected by the emergence of brood X. So you could look at a map of the occurrences of this mysterious ailment and an occurrence of brood X cicadas this year, mm-hmm. and it was a really good geographic overlap. More importantly, though, there was a very strong temporal overlap, where on the 18th of May, Jennifer Toussaint in Arlington, Virginia, who is an animal control agent, went from zero calls to 20 calls about dead and dying birds in her yard. And not her yard, yeah. but in people's yard. Yeah. They were calling the animal control officer. Mm-hmm. And it lasted for 2 months. And then it regressed when the cicadas all died. So that, to me, is strong circumstantial evidence that the cicadas are involved. But the really curious thing from a puzzle standpoint and a sort of a disease standpoint is that it was all juveniles.
Yeah, fledglings. Yeah, right.
Fledglings. And so that gets at the whole question of how could it be an infectious disease if people were seeing healthy American robins feeding blind fledglings? What was going on here?
Yeah.
So my mind leapt to perhaps they're getting the baby birds are getting something in the cicadas, whether it's a chemical toxin produced by people or perhaps a neurotoxin produced by the cicadas themselves, or a neurotoxin perhaps produced by the fungus Massospora cicadina that infects these cicadas. They were getting something in the cicadas that was causing them to develop this affliction. And the parents were spared. Mm-hmm. So is that because baby birds are still developing and their nervous systems are immature and they couldn't fight off whatever this thing was? So those are the open questions to me, and those are the really interesting points to me.
Did you look back 17 years ago to the last brood X to see if there were similar patterns of affliction, I should say?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because my dear friend Bob Mulvihill, who is the ornithologist at the National Aviary in Pittsburgh, and I have been corresponding and talking on the phone about this, kind of comparing, because of course he gets a million calls, mm-hmm. and I get a million Facebook messages, and we're both just gathering data out of the air, and we compared notes for a nice 40-minute yak, and he and I both arrived at the conclusion that the people to ask about this are wildlife rehabilitators. People like me who are taking in, you know, injured and orphaned birds.
And these are official designations, by the way, just want to
clarify.
Yeah,
it's
that,
a federal, you need federal and state permits to do it. And there are people who are licensed to do it. And so Bob developed a little survey question that he's going to send out through the National Association of Wildlife Rehabilitators to ask them precisely that question. And what did you see in the last invasion of brood X? Or if you live in a part of the country where there are other broods, have you ever seen this? And part of that idea that Bob and I had was sparked by a tidbit of information that I got when I asked my wildlife rehabilitator friend, Katie Fallon of the Cheat Lake Animal Hospital in Cheat Lake, West Virginia. They have an organization called the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia. Mm-hmm. And I said, Katie, have you ever seen this before? She said, yes, we have seen this affliction before. And it was in 2016. And that turns out to be the last time brood five cicadas were prevalent in that area of West Virginia and in my area of Southern Ohio.
Is that a big brood too?
Yeah, it's the corresponding brood, you know, to brood X. You know, the Northern Ohio has brood X and Western Ohio has brood X, and and I happen to be in brood five. So she has seen this affliction before in several birds in a cicada invasion year in 2016. And my friends at the Ohio Wildlife Center also asserted that they have seen this condition before. Now, what we need to uncover is, was it during cicada years? So I don't have that answer from the Ohio Wildlife Center yet. I think everybody's just madly crunching data at this point. But I continue to cling to the cicada idea because I think the circumstantial evidence is so strong, you know, that somehow the bugs are involved.
I want to talk more about that. My guest is Julie Zicafus, naturalist, artist, and author of several books, including her latest, Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. We'll have Julie will be back with us. If you have a question or comment for Julie Zicafus, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I'm going to post a link to her blog because you have to read her blog. It's the best. On our website at WOSU.org/allsides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The reports of sick and dying birds with eye swelling and crusty discharge started rolling into state wildlife management offices in May. Most of those birds afflicted by the mysterious condition are fledglings from a raft of common grackles, blue jays, European starlings, American robins, and a few others. And the problem has naturalists talking, theorizing, and speculating across the country, and that includes author and artist and naturalist Julie Zicafus, who has donated much of her life to the preservation of nature, especially birds, and she joins us today. Julie, I'm wondering, you know, you talked at the very, when we were talking about the correlation between this condition and brood X, cicada brood X, you mentioned that some people were trying to poison them to, you know, to get rid of them. And I'm wondering if that doesn't drive you bonkers to think about people wanting to eradicate part of the cycle of nature in our world.
You know, anytime you have big nature, when you have something like coconut crabs crossing highways in Fiji, or you know, cicadas just crawling en masse up the tree trunks and wading through insects, people get scared. It freaks them out. And there was an unfortunate amount of media drumbeating about this brood in particular, because it was going to hit Washington, D.C., and that's where all the news media outlets are located.
Yeah.
So it became this sort of invasion of the zombies kind of thing, and people had fun with it. And, you know, those of us who are out there saying this is natural, it only lasts a couple months, then it's gone, you know, it's okay, nobody's going to die, no trees are going to die. We were all kind of drowned out by the hysteria. So one of the kind of interesting ideas about this is, well, number one, you can't spray for them, no matter what the large chemical companies tell you in their ads. Mm-hmm. You can't spray for cicadas because you'd have to spray your entire trees and soak your lawns. And that's exactly what they recommend you do. And it's ludicrous because these things are living underground for 17 years, sometimes 6 or 8 feet underground, sucking on tree roots, and they laboriously dig their way up in the, you know, dark of the night and come out. the other thing is, the only thing they do to the trees is they give them a twig pruning.
Yeah.
They don't kill the trees.
Right.
They just kill the outer 6 or 8 inches of the tree's twigs. And those droop and then fall to the ground, and the eggs hatch, and the cicada pupae crawl out, the larvae crawl out, and start the cycle all over again. So there's no reason to spray for them. You cannot stop them. It's like putting up a snow fence for a tsunami. You can't.
And they're great food for birds and stuff. And my dog, by the way, in the backyard.
Yes, my dog too.
One of the things, she was just playing with one the other day. One of the things they've advised bird lovers to do, home bird watchers, is to take down bird feeders. What are your thoughts? And to clean them if you're going to put them back up. But what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm going to say that I think it's a great idea to take down bird feeders in the summer.
Okay.
And that's because of what I've observed over the years of the patterns that certain species have in feeder utilization. House finches in particular have a very, very long juvenile dependency period. They will beg from their parents for as long as the parents will put up with it. And so what house finches do is they park their young, brood after brood, at our tube feeders. And the birds gorge on nothing but seed all day. And then they, because house finches are very inbred little characters, they're all descended from a very small founder stock of maybe 100 birds that was released in Long Island in the probably 1940s. So they have a very low genetic resistance to any disease. So I call them flying petri dishes. So what happens in the summer is we get all these little petri dishes sitting on our feeders, catching whatever disease happens to be around and transmitting it to birds that are not flying petri dishes. And that makes me mad, frankly. So I took my feeders down because I have salmonella going around in my area. And I have found 4 or 5 dead house finches and a dying mourning dove. And I said, okay, there's my little tap from the universe to take it down. I'll make it clear they were not afflicted by this mystery thing. This was clearly salmonella, which is just puffed up, lethargic, bright clear eyes, dies, you know.
Okay.
So I'll preface my comments with, it's a good idea not to feed in the summer. And I applaud taking down the feeders. However, where this affliction is concerned, I remain skeptical that it's passed around at feeders.
Okay.
Because it's only affecting insectivorous juveniles of large-bodied birds. Blue jays are not feeding their young sunflower seeds. They're feeding them insects. Same for cardinals. Same for American robins. Hmm. American robins don't even come to feeders, and they're one of the most heavily affected birds.
Okay.
So I look at the state game department's dictum to take down your feeders to prevent the spread of this disease.
Yeah.
It's not a disease that we know of, and taking down your feeders is probably not going to prevent the spread of this particular affliction.
There's, you know, every time I talk, there's a million questions I have, but I also have people who want to talk to you as well, listeners.
Awesome.
Let's first remind people that you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and that my guest this hour is Julie Zicafoos, naturalist, artist, and author of several books, including the latest, Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. And Kayla in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Kayla.
Hi. I'm very excited to talk to you, Julie. I read your book after Saving Jemima, after the last time I listened to an interview with you on Fresh Air. Made me cry a lot. I have a very strong association of blue jays with my grandma because she would always have a lot of them in her yard because she fed them a lot. And after she passed, I just, every time I see a blue jay, I think of her. So reading that book was really special to me.
Very sweet. Yeah, I love those those affiliations of birds with our loved ones. I have them too.
Yeah.
Kayla,
thank you so much for writing that.
Oh, well, thank you for reading it, and thank you for you know, believing in birds as messengers. I think that's a very potent thing.
Yeah, Kayla, thank you so much. I appreciate the call. Let's see. Steve in Grandview, you're on the air. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. this explains something that happened to me like 10 days ago or something like that. I was at Elm Creek State Park, and this little bird walked up to three of us, didn't fly, just walked up and seemed to be completely tame. And somehow I thought it was like a juvenile, and I had this feeling that it was orphaned, you know, that it was looking for its parent, and it thought the three of us standing there, humans, were its parent because it kept walking closer to us and seemed to have no fear of us at all. And I had heard of some kind of bird disease, but I didn't make or bird affliction. But I didn't make any connection with that. And now I realize that that bird was probably blind, and it probably was a juvenile, and that its location in the central Ohio area was in an area that had a lot of cicadas. And I noticed that because 17 years ago, I noticed a lot more of them in town. And this year, partly because I moved and don't live as close as many trees, but there were not nearly as many. You couldn't hear that cicada song in town. But if you went still in Franklin County, but like, you know, out around Elm Creek or something, you know, if you went to a park, then they were, you could hear that wonderful sound and see them. So I think you're right on target. It just chokes me that anybody would want to hurt those cicadas, because every 17 years, I just love that sound. I mean, I could listen to it all the time.
I think of it like a tuning fork almost.
Really, it wakes you up, and it's not like you heard it last year. It takes you back.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think you're spot on with this, and I hope that in another, well, they come out every year, but the McCormick mentioned something that
Jim,
that the X, whatever our brood is, thrives because there's such tasty food for things like birds that in other years there's not so many of them, and the predators eat them all. But in this cycle, there's so many they can't eat them all. So this cycle thrives. It's kind of, you know, a cool evolutionary thing. Anyway, this is really fun, and I'll go let you go to the next caller.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. From Bob, he asks if Julie has foxes on her 80 acres, red or gray.
Bob, I've had both species on the 80 acres, but this is 29 years of records here. The most recently, I had a den of gray foxes, and that was an incredible thing to see, and it was within sight of the house. Gray foxes are declining precipitously and are in big, big trouble, and nobody is really sure why, what's going on with gray foxes. Both species in the area, I would say red is a bit more prevalent now, but I still hear the screams of gray foxes in the summer.
Lenora in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Lenora.
Hi. You just dissuaded me from my finch feeders, which I have, but this year, early in the year, I had finch food out, and it was a mixed, and there were several other breeds of birds that came to my feeder besides the finches, and there was one bird that was a long, thin, much larger than a warbler, but the only bird that I could find that matched the coloring would be the golden wing warbler or the Brewster's warbler. It was a very thin bird and much longer than a warbler, and it fed off the ground, off the pieces that came down from the feeders. Any ideas what that might have been?
I do have an idea what that might have been, and it's very, very similar in markings to the golden wing warbler, which is very rare. And that is the yellow-throated warbler. You're going to want to look at that bird. It's a common feeder visitor where it's present. It comes very early in the spring and often subsists on things like sunflower chips and hearts, and picks around its seeds and peanut hearts and takes suet and things like that. And I've been blessed with this long, slender, long-billed, gray, white, yellow, and blackbird at my feeder too. So yellow-throated warbler. Don't get confused with common yellow throat. You're looking for the yellow-throated.
Lenora, thanks a lot. You know, which reminds me of how I used to be confused about the red-headed woodpecker and the red-breasted woodpecker. And I don't know if you saw on Facebook, but I finally saw my first, not just one red-headed woodpecker, but several in Hocking Hills. And
yes.
I just got to sit on a friend's deck and just watch them to my heart's content. And we really think that they were nesting around there.
Yeah.
They must have been. And what a spectacular vision to see that bird.
That was my husband's favorite bird.
Yeah.
And whenever I feel like I need a connection with him, I drive or bike about a mile and a half from here where there's a small colony year round. And I listen for their churring calls and the white and black pinwheel of their wings. And there's something about the cleanliness of the coloration of that bird that
yeah.
just as an artist, you know, it probably just lights you on
and
fire.
That perfect red. It's a
yes,
perfect
the perfect,
red.
And it's an alizarin crimson. It's not just red. It's like a cool crimson. It's not a scarlet tanager.
Nope.
Scarlet. It's cooler.
It's got some
it's a
blue.
Better color.
It's got yeah. some blue in it. Yeah.
It has some blue in it.
Beautiful.
Exactly. Yeah.
And
love
was,
that bird. Love it. Love it.
So glad to be disabused of that. Let's see. Real quick, we'll take another quick call. Michael in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
So I was, I experienced two doves, or family of doves. They had two eggs. One of them hatched, the other didn't. And the family, the mom and dad, abandoned the nest. So we were taking care of the baby and feeding it. And, it had trouble. It couldn't keep its head up. And I think I remember that was one of the symptoms of this affliction. And I was wondering if you had noticed that, doves, were part of this affliction or not. It died a few days later. So
yeah.
it never really developed too much.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry to hear that. Well, mourning doves are not part of the species complex that's afflicted by this. And they are strict vegetarians. And in your story, there are far too many variables to ever to be able to say what killed the dove. But I would guess that proper diet or being too cool might have been part of the problem. Doves are vegetarians, but they take a very, very high protein pigeon milk from their parents in their first 6 or 7 days of life. So unless you're prepared to replicate that, they can be a little tricky to raise. So I would not say that this death of this bird was due to this affliction. No.
Michael, thanks a lot for that call. Great question. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back with Julie Vizikafus, naturalist, artist, and author of many books. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher, and this hour is going by way too fast. My guest is author, artist, and naturalist Julie Vizikafus. She plies her trade largely from her home in the Appalachian foothills of southern Ohio, but she also travels around the country when we aren't in the middle of a pandemic and speaks to groups and takes them on birding tours and all kinds of things. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Julie, just before we move on, I want to clarify that you don't think people should have put out bird feeders in the summer, not because of this affliction, but just in general, because it disrupts the natural patterns of behavior. And I have a question, a follow-up to that is, if you want to attract, you know, during the spring migration, is it okay to put them out so you can see the birds that are flying through the neighborhood?
Well, I am among the most lenient of bird feeder operators, so I'm as much swatting my own wrist as I am yours. I, in fact, still have a tiny weensy little feeder going, and in that I put my special Zik dough, which is a very rich concoction of peanut butter and oats and cornmeal and chick starter and lard. And I'm feeding a pair of chipping sparrows, who are raising their third brood now. Okay. And I adore them so much that it's very, very difficult for me. So I kind of lied when I said I'd taken down all my feeders.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. The other thing that worries me about feeders in summer is the way baby woodpeckers also park on them and basically eat a diet of straight peanuts all day. And that's not good. You know, we're not helping the babies to learn how to forage in tree bark and pound holes in wood, which is what they should be doing. So I really do have questions about the behavioral impacts of offering an abundant, endless food supply to juvenile birds. What happens then if you go on vacation? You know, mm-hmm. like what happens to those baby birds? So I tapered mine off and said, tough, you know, go learn how to be a woodpecker.
And likewise, Melissa sent us an email asking, Julie, do you also recommend taking down bird baths? Now, again, you don't recommend taking down bird feeders because of this affliction. Again, it's a behavior modification issue. But right. Bird baths, no. I mean, giving birds water is good.
I keep my bird baths going, but I keep them real clean.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you're going to strip yourself of the joy of offering bird food during the summer, at least keep the bath going and make sure it's clean. Now, with the caveat that if you have puffed up, sick looking birds in your yard that are sitting on your bird bath and drinking from it, you better be out there with the bleach every day, you know, disinfecting that bird bath if you want to keep it going. Right now, since I've taken down the feeders, I've stopped finding the salmonella infected birds around the yard. And I get healthy birds at the bird bath. I have two little fountains going for them, and mm-hmm. it brings me great joy. I need something, you know, because like, I don't want to strip people of everything here. Right. And I certainly don't want to make it sound like a panacea for an affliction we don't even understand, you know, that, oh, if we take our bird feeders down, it won't spread. Well, that's not, doesn't actually seem to be what's happening. You know, it doesn't seem to be coming from bird feeders.
Let's see, Monica and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Monica. Oops, Monica went away. All right, Julie and Groveport, you're on the air. Hi, Julie.
Hi, I'm going to keep this brief because I want an explanation, but the long and short of it is a janitor at the school where I work gave me 6 ducks that he and his son could not live without when they were at Quality Farm and Fleet as ducklings. And yeah. So they grew in his apartment and then finally grew in a dog pen until I heard him over say, I need a home for ducks, and I have 5 acres in a pond. So he brought them to me. They were mostly mallards. In a matter of days, the males disappeared. And 1 female remained. Now, I'm not sure what happened to the other 2 females, but we had one that was wary enough to survive. She's been with us for 2 years. We feed her occasionally corn. And then about 2 weeks ago, she disappeared. And the male did also. And I was furious because I thought a neighbor dog might have gotten there. Uh-huh. And complaining in my intimate yard. I have a yard that's fenced around our house. And I hear this little, and it was her. And here she's sitting on 9 eggs in a pile of pampas grass inside our fence. And I'm wondering from you, the question I have for you is, how do I corral the ducklings safely enough to prevent her from walking them out to the pond and having them be drug underwater by turtles? Because I know that's going to happen.
Oh, by turtles.
That's a really, really tough one. You know, the brood attrition is part of what happens. You'll see a mother duck with, you know, 12 babies, and then you'll see her with 6, and then you'll see her with 3. I don't think there's any preventing the snapping turtle predation, and I don't know enough about raising ducks to know whether you can get them to a certain size, you know, where they're no longer vulnerable. You know, that might be one approach, would be to pen raise them until with a kiddie pool, until you feel they're strong and fast enough not to be just complete, you know, s'mores for snapping turtles.
That's an interesting
that's just
question.
I think if I were emotionally attached to these ducklings, that might be what I'd try. They grow like weeds. It wouldn't take long to get them big and strong.
Okay, Julie, hope that helps. Let's see. Harry in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Harry.
Hi. I'm interested in whether or not you have the same reservations about hummingbird feeders and hummingbirds as you do with other birds.
Okay.
I keep my hummingbird feeders going in the summer. I think that the likelihood of taking down hummingbird feeders, preventing the spread of this affliction, is about zero. So I kind of smile when I see advice that even hummingbird feeders must be taken down, because what? You know, what? It affects insectivores that eat cicadas. So I think you should keep your feeders up and keep them clean. Okay, change that solution every 4 days and we'll wash those feeders with hot soapy water.
Let's see. We have an interesting email from Nancy, who identifies as a conservationist. She said, both Black Swamp Bird Observatory and Toledo Metro Parks have given out the alert to remove bird feeders to try to avoid this affliction from spreading. This is Northwest Ohio and must be occurring here. I do not believe we had the cicadas broodex, and the other annual cicadas are not out yet. Now, I don't know. I mean, there's... what do you make of it, Julie?
I think it's fine. I think, you know, in an abundance of caution, you know, it makes sense to take down bird feeders just in case there's a link there. And I think it's not harmful advice, but I did want to split that hair of, you know, what birds were actually being afflicted, where, and whether feeders could actually play a role in that. I do, as I say, I've taken down my feeders for the summer, except for that tiny one. And, you know, I think it's good advice.
Let's see, Jeffrey in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hey, thanks for doing the show. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
I know some states have reported that the incidence of the affliction dropped off after people had taken down their feeders. My question is, does this drop-off correspond to the disappearance of cicadas?
Right.
Yeah, ding. Yes, it does. It does. I think one of the strongest little bits of evidence, and again, I don't have the answers here. I'm just spitballing like everybody else. But that animal control officer from Virginia, Toussaint, who said that they went from zero calls to 20 calls on the 18th of May, she said, the cases reported snowballed so quickly that it seemed like an overnight event. What else seems like an overnight event? The emergence of cicadas in May. And now that she says the onset was at the same time the cicadas started, but the intake of patients has dropped off when the cicadas have disappeared. So at least in the Washington, D.C. area, there was a strong correlation to the number of cases and the whether or not the cicadas were still present in the environment.
There is an email from Carmen, and Jeffrey, thank you so much for that call. Carmen asks, could the bird affliction also be affecting squirrels? I've seen 2 dead squirrels in my neighborhood in the last week that were not hit by vehicles. And again, this is a whole cross-species thing. I mean, what do you think, Julie?
I have no idea, not qualified to even speculate. However, I would say that one finds dead animals, one finds dead birds, but in this pandemic climate, with this scare of this bird affliction, we are all hypersensitized to that. I mean, you find dead squirrels all the time, or at least I do, and I found a dead meadow vole in the middle of an organic farm the other day, and I was like, huh, wonder what killed that meadow vole, not a mark on it. It's hard to say. It's impossible for me to speculate what might have killed the squirrels or whether whatever toxin is in the cicadas could also affect mammals. I just don't know.
Generally, Julie, what's your advice to people if they encounter a sick bird? What's the protocol?
Well, my protocol as a rehabber is a lot different from what I'd advised people, but you know, I'd leave it alone. Mm-hmm. And if you find a bird that appears to have died of illness, i.e. it's puffed up. It's been sitting there. It's lethargic. And, you know, it's you've been seeing it around and then you find it dead. I would dispose of it in the household trash in a Ziploc bag. I happen to, you know, since I burn my trash out here in the country, I burn carcasses that are suspect and I handle them with gloves. This is not been shown to be a zoonotic, in other words, a disease that has leapt from birds to humans by any means, but it's always a good idea to be very careful. And I've been a fanatic hand washer since I was a little kid, you know, because I wind up working with sick birds and things like that. It doesn't matter. Anytime I touch any animal or bird, I'm washing my hands immediately after and not getting around food. So I would just advise, just treat it as if it's toxic, you know.
Let's see, Peter in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I just wanted to mention Salmonella again. And this is kind of crazy. If you read the Bible story of Moses and the miracle of the quails, the people ate these little birds. They fly across the Mediterranean or the Red Sea. They're pooped out. So they just plunk down, and you can walk over and pick them up. And Moses promised people to eat meat. Well, a lot of people died, and I don't believe in miracles. I believe they were sick. These birds either had been eating poisonous seeds from a hemlock or something, or they might have had salmonella, you know. The symptoms in the Bible seem similar. I think it's very funny. And I researched it. The Egyptians now have outlawed collection of these quails. Because they're going extinct, but they're still there. And they fly across the entire Mediterranean. Pliny the Elder said that they land on this rigging of ships, and the ships get top heavy and tip over sometimes. There's so many of them. Thank you.
What a crazy
That's
world.
Pretty cool. Thanks. That's a comment you wouldn't get every day. I appreciate that.
That was interesting. You know, Julie, just before we have a few more minutes left, and I'm wondering, I wanted to talk about how birds as indicator species and what that means.
Yeah. It's there, you know, the classic canary in the coal mine. I think probably the strongest messages birds are giving us right now are concerned climate change and the decline in abundance of insects. The entire world rests on six legs. We need to preserve our insect populations and reverse those things that we're doing that cause these drastic declines. I was very distressed to have hit three butterflies as I was racing in from town today with my car. I'm one of these people who tries to dodge them. And, you know, I got to thinking, it's just, when's the last time you had to clean your windshield because it was covered with
insects? That's for sure. I mean, I just did a 5-hour road trip yesterday. Not a one.
There you go.
Not a one.
Exactly. And that's, you know, we're out there with our we're basically seining for insects when we drive on the highways.
Yeah.
And they are not out there. So, you know, it's no wonder that we're losing songbirds at such a precipitous rate because the food is not there for them for as many as we are used to having.
And just finally, you typically travel the country, as I said, giving it talks about your work and more, and you couldn't do that last year or much of this year. And ironically, more people than ever have turned to nature during the shutdown. I mean, are you looking forward to a busy time once it gets revved back up again? More interest.
Yeah, I wish I could say I was, but, you know, I've become, there's this thing that happens with captive parrots where they get cage bound. Like if they spend too much time in their cage, they don't want to come out.
Uh-huh.
And I'm kind of like a cage bound parrot right now. I'm kind of like, hey, I sort of like not going out anywhere. You know? So I'm a little worried about that. Or like a dog that's kenneled too
much. That's so funny.
You know? So yes, I just did an event, this past weekend concerning moth the palooza and I was just participating but kind of there to add a little sparkle or pizzazz or whatever it is I brought to it, and I thought, you know, this is kind of weird being around 40 people in a room. I'm not used to this. I think I'll go out for some air. So I gotta say I'm a little traumatized, you know.
Gotcha.
Not ready.
I hear you,
not
girl.
Ready.
I hear you.
Yeah,
well, thank you so much. It's been great to see you and talk to you again, and I'm gonna get down there.
Oh, I would love that. I have so much to show you.
Julie Zicafus, naturalist, artist, and author of many books, including the most recent Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. Julie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anne.
That's it for now. Thanks for all the great calls and emails. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.